Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. Since the cancellation of the 2020 festival, we've been working hard to ensure that this year's program has a new story. Over the coming months, we'll be reimagining a significant number of sessions that were scheduled to take place on our festival stages as podcasts, bringing the writing, ideas, and debates from the 2020 program to online audiences around Australia and the world.
Hey, Kevin.
Hey, how are you, Anne?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay.
So Kevin and I are best friends. I don't think we should try to pretend that, you know, this is some ethical piece of journalism in which I am interviewing you and asking you hard-hitting questions. When did we meet? What year? Do you remember?
Yeah, it was 2001, the spring, I think, of 2001, because you had won the Pim Faulkner for Bel Canto.
It must have been, you know, then it was 2002, because Bel Canto came out.
Oh, yeah, it was 2002.
All right, all right.
It was, because then I went to grad school in the fall.
That's right, and it was Easter. It was Easter weekend, that's why you were the only person in the audience.
No, that's not true.
It was really close. There were five people. There were five people reading, and I think there were five people in the audience.
Well, I was happy to be there.
Yeah, and then you became my dog sitter for a while.
Yeah,
I asked you. You had just moved back home. And you seemed like you weren't up to anything in particular. And so I asked if you would want to come and live with my dog. And that must have been when I was on paperback tour for Bel Canto.
It was. Okay. Yeah, because you were going back out on tour. I was living with my parents. And my mom was like, Ann Patchett's on the phone. I was like, what? And then so I took care of Rose.
Yeah.
I just remember because I was maybe living with my parents too long, you know, like they were taking care of me. And so you gave me this place where all I did all day long was walk Rose. And then you would leave books before you went out. Like, so you'd leave like Henry Green or John Updike, and I'd read them. And when you came back, we'd talk about them. And that was like the span of my life for a while, was just walking Rose and reading books. And it was like the happiest I'd been.
I also really remember, like, one of the first times I ever met Leanne, and you guys were going out on a date, and I was racing around trying to get ready, and you guys were sitting on the couch saying, well, good night.
That's right. Oh, my God. I forgot.
And it was really,
that.
Really adorable.
Yeah. I think, I mean, for me, in so many ways, when you reached out to me and we became friends, I was right at the beginning of whatever was going to happen to me as a writer. And so there was just this kind of like, once I kind of became friends with you, I was like, oh, here's a roadmap, like to navigate this without losing yourself, right? Like the decisions that you make as a writer and the things that you write about and the way that you conduct yourself, it was just like a roadmap, and I knew I wasn't going to end up in maybe the same place, but I knew that that was a good way to start, right? So it was always so helpful. I don't know what I would have done without that, and I feel like so much of our relationship is you kind of telling me what I need to do to like not go crazy, so that's always been helpful.
But what's so strange to me is I feel like I've never helped you as a writer. Like, I have all of these writer friends, and we read each other's work, and we mark it up, and we edit, and we have all these conversations about the plot and what's going to happen, and we don't have that at all in our relationship. Like, we talk about writing, but much more from the place of what are you reading, or where do you have to go, or what do you have to do, but I feel like you just go off and write your books.
Yeah, I mean, I don't show anyone my work ever.
I shouldn't take it personally.
No, I don't ever. I just, it just seems like an imposition, and I like keeping it to myself. You know, I like it being my secret until I'm done with it. And so what's always been great about when we meet is that we really focus on the thing that we love, which I think is reading, you know,
yeah.
Maybe even more than writing, is just there aren't many people that read as many books as we do, I think. And yeah. So it's nice to have somebody when you've read a book that you can believe that they'll have read it too.
Also that we both read a lot of galleys.
Yeah.
And that's sort of taken over our lives. And there isn't anybody that you can sit down and say, I'm reading this book that's not going to come out for 5 months
yeah.
that I really love.
And I think for me, talking about reading is a way for us to talk about writing, in that we start to figure out like the things that we love, like stylistically where we yeah. may be different. And so those moments when we both love a book equally, it's neat to think about why, you know? And so that helps me think about my own writing, but I don't know. I always just want to talk about books.
So does Leanne not read your stuff while you're writing it?
No.
So interesting.
Leanne will read it at the end when I'm done, but you know, with the kids and everything, it just feels like work to give it to her at this point. She listens to me talk about it, you know, but again, like, I just feel like if somebody reads the words before I'm done, it's going to mess it up. You know, it won't be right.
Do you tell your plots to people? Do we talk about a plot? No, I didn't.
Not really.
Well, but you know, I think about the Bear book.
Yeah.
We did talk about that, yeah. But maybe... maybe that's why it didn't come to pass.
No, I'll talk about it with you because I think both of us like thinking about structure, like how
yes.
we're starting. And
yes.
so with you, I will talk about the ideas I have for a book. And Leanne, my wife, I will, but that's it. You know, I just have a weird thing about like the privacy, the intimacy of writing for me is what I love is that it's in my head. And I just like keeping it there as long as possible. Do you talk to Carl about does he read your work?
Carl. Carl's my husband. I always say, you know, I staple a $20 bill every 5 or 10 pages into the manuscript just to give him the incentive to keep going. It's my relationship with Carl and all of that has been so hard. Although I think he's right. His whole thing is, everybody loves you because you're Ann Patchett and I love you because you're Ann.
Mm-hmm.
And he's so supportive of my career and my decisions and all the weird things I do. I mean, we've had like 5 different people in our house in the last 2 weeks. And Carl is always saying, oh, this is so great. You bring so many wonderful people into our lives. Everything I do, he's supportive. Oh, you know, honey, I'm going away again and again and again. And he's great. I'm so proud of you. But he cannot stand to sit down and read my books.
Yeah.
It's excruciating for him. But he's really helpful in talking through practical things, mostly medical, because he's a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm thinking about a book right now, and I'm trying to decide if the character's dying. And so then I'm trying to decide if they do have a terminal disease, what is it? And then I'm always saying to him, okay, so I want something where the person's not in pain, but they have 3 months to live, and... you know, he really will sit down and take that seriously, but he also finds that very creepy. I remember walking out of a hardware store with him one day a couple of years ago, and we'd bought a wrench, and I was holding the wrench, and we were getting in the car, and I said, do you think I could kill somebody with this wrench? And he was like, what happened to you as a child? Like, you can't even just hold a wrench without thinking of the terrible things the wrench could do.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's weird that you mean, like, I do an exercise with my students where I just give them an object, and I'm like, now figure out how to utilize this in a narrative just immediately, and it's always like a pineapple, a dog collar, something. And what's interesting to me is, like, whenever they falter, violence is always the answer. Like, any object you can basically utilize for violence. So it's always the easy way into a narrative. It's like you hit someone with a pineapple, you strangle someone with a dog collar. So maybe that's just the way my brain works with conflict. I'm like, oh, just run to violence.
That's really interesting. I remember when I used to teach back in the old days, I had a no-death policy in my workshop. I always said that if you're going to kill a character, you have to make an appointment and come and talk with me first, because it was so default. It was like, you know, I don't know how to end the story. I'll have the character be hit by a bus. Never a car, always a bus. And I would say, you know, that you just can't do it. You can't use death to solve your problems.
I think we've talked about this before maybe, but one of my professors at Vanderbilt when I was first learning how to write was Walter Sullivan, who it was in his probably late 70s at the time, but I'm sure he'd been reading student stories forever, and there was so much death, you know. And I remember one kid had written a story where someone dies, and Walter just kind of looked tired, and he was like, you know, if you ever ask your characters what do they want, almost always they'll say, I want to live. So can you find a way to let them live? And that really resonated with me for the rest of the time that I've ever written with my characters. It's not like I want to avoid danger, or it's not that I can't put them in danger or hurt them, but I always ask myself, like, could I keep them alive? Can I save them in some way? And if I can find that way, I'm going to try to work the narrative towards that.
Now my mind is running through all of your body of work, and people don't die.
I try not to kill people.
And then
sometimes I'll bring them back to life if they're
dead. Right, Wildfire Johnny.
Yeah.
Right, the guy who cuts his throat over and over and over and over again and just pops right back up.
Yeah, my stories sometimes are weird, or my novels have strange conceits, but I don't want my characters to get hurt. And maybe that's just a tenderness that means I can't write certain stories, but for me, I just always have that line in my head, I want to live, you know, and so I just try to figure that out.
Yeah, it's like I'm so bad at villainy. I can kill them. I can have horrible things happen to them, but I don't have any ability for villains.
Yeah, I think about that with your work. And one of the things that really resonated with me when I was learning how to write and reading your work was the complexity that you give to complicated characters, right? And that if you stretch time long enough, those characters that seemed evil or like the source of all the pain,
right,
when you stretch out that timeline, they get folded into the narrative and become part of a family or become understandable. And that was a real thing for me to figure out, too. Like, if I can just stretch time out a little bit, I can give them enough time to redeem themselves.
Right, right. I always thought I would be such a crummy lawyer because I can always see both sides of everything. And then I start to think, oh, this is my villain. No, really, not so villainous, not so bad. I remember there was a character in Run who I thought was really a pretty bad guy, the oldest son, Sullivan. And I went out on book tour, and every single person said to me, oh, my God, my favorite character, Sullivan. Oh, I just loved him. And I thought, wow, you know, I just can't get close to it.
Is that a weird sensation for you when people tell you who their favorite character is? Or
it's a zero sensation. It's just, by the time I finish a book, it is gone forever from me. So by the time it's out in galley, I no longer care. So the only people's opinions that really move me are the people who have read the book before it's in galley. By the time it's published, people will say, oh, I love Sullivan. And I'm thinking, Sullivan, did I go to high school with a Sullivan? You know, I can't remember who they are. Do you stay attached?
Yeah, I mean, I think those characters live in my head longer. They echo for a while. They do kind of. I still kind of hold them in my head. It's not that I'm making new stories for them, but part of the way that my brain works is looping. I have to be very careful about what I put in my brain because it's there for good. And so with my characters, when I put them in my brain, even though I'm not writing new stories for them, I'm reliving, I'm remembering what has happened to them. So it just kind of loops.
That's really interesting because I know that when I'm writing something, if it's fiction or nonfiction, I will read it endlessly, over and over and over again. I just wrote this super long essay for a lecture I have to give in the fall, and I feel like I've read it 100 times. Mm-hmm. But it's about distancing myself from it, that I want to read it until I am so sick of it that I break with it, I'm free of it, and I think, that's it, I'm never going to look at that thing again. And then I can go on.
Yeah. I would, for me, like, probably 75% of writing for me is reading what I'm already written.
Oh.
It's just reading it over and
Absolutely.
Over and over
Absolutely.
And over until that kind of going back eventually creates momentum enough for me to move forward. And then when I lose that, I just go back and again and again.
I always think of it as like folding in a batter, where you know, you've got the batter and then you're supposed to fold in egg whites and you put in a little bit and you just turn it in. So if I'm sitting down to a novel and I'm on page 60, I sit down and look at page 50 and then work inside page 50 to 60.
Nice.
And at the end of the day, I'm on page 63. Yeah. But it's not like I started at page 60 and wrote three pages. You know, it just sort of bumps out in a way.
Yeah.
All right, which brings me to wanting to talk about how fast you wrote Nothing to See Here. How fast you wrote it, how fast I read it.
Yeah, I wrote it really fast. I had been, in my head, I'd been, ever since I wrote my novel, The Family Fang, and that came out in 2011, I knew I was going to write about kids that burst into flames, and I just knew that was coming. And so when I know that's happening, I just let it sit, and I just live with it, and until, again, I'm going through it over and over again, and I try to get that, even the first page, like what it would look like on the page. I'm just trying to hold it all in my head. And so then when I sit down to write, if it goes well, it can be fast, right? And that particular instance of writing in 10 days was just like, I was on sabbatical, I was out of town, I was in a little crummy cabin in Black Mountain, North Carolina. There was nothing else to do. And there was just this moment where I was so deep into it, I just said, you should finish it, just go. And so I just lived very strangely for 10 days and just woke up when the sun came up and I wrote, and then the house would be dark because I'd never turned on a light, you know? And so when the sun went down, that's when I knew the day was over, and I'd put the computer down and eat something and I'd read a little bit and then I'd go to bed. And I did that for 10 days. And there was just that moment where I was like, do you want to finish this? And I was like, let's just do it. And I finished it.
And does that ever seem a little sad? Like, you had this great book and this great idea, and then you got it all done? Because I do, I mean, I'm a dog always on the wrong side of the door. If I'm writing, I want to be finished. And if I'm finished, I want to be writing. So I'm both really attracted to that story, and also it makes me a little sad.
I had them in my head, though, for maybe 7 years, right?
Oh,
like,
okay.
Like Bessie and Roland, like I knew what they looked like, and they were just with me all the time. Not in some, I'm not like a ghost, like, I just in my head. They were with me, and so all that time there was a point where I was like, you need to start, right? And the writing is, sometimes I love being in my head with the story, and that's where the real fun is. And the writing is just muscle memory. It's just mechanics for me.
Yeah, I always think everything that rises must converge. So I think and think and think about a story, and I don't write it until the point at which the idea of not writing it becomes more painful than the idea of writing
it. That's nice, yeah.
And I'm always trying to lower that cross point. Like, you're going to do this, why torture yourself? You know, why not just go ahead and write it?
Which book of yours took the shortest amount of time to write?
Oh, that's interesting. Probably Truth and Beauty, but that doesn't count because it was a memoir and it was also a really short book. I mean, I could say the Dutch House took a really short amount of time because I wrote a whole draft that was completely wrong and threw it out.
Yeah.
And then I couldn't figure out. But when I finally figured it out, I wrote it really fast. Commonwealth was the easiest book to write. It was the most fun book to write. Bel Canto was the worst book to write.
Really?
I mean, and maybe in some ways the Dutch House was the worst book to write, because I certainly have never finished a whole book and thought, nope, work. I'm going to throw that out. Have you ever written a whole book and thrown it out? Or
no, I've written almost a whole book and thrown it out. But no, I mean, by that point, I have a feeling I'm going to get to the end, and if it's bad, it's bad. But yeah, I kind of know before that, and I stop. But yeah, I think. For me too, my second novel was Perfect Little World, which was like a 500-page book about babies, and there were so many characters, and it spanned a decade, and just, I think, and I had lived with that book in my head for a while, but like, the actual writing of it was so difficult, like keeping the timeline, keeping the names, all of this, and I was like, this is work, like this isn't, it's becoming less muscle memory, and it's more like trying to like keep everything together, And so with this new, with Nothing to See Here, I knew before I even started, I was like, this is going to be short. I'm going to have a constrained space. I'm going to have a very limited amount of time, like a timeline. And just telling myself all that made it a lot easier to write too, because I just kept, every time I saw the story opening up, I narrowed it, you know, like there was a point where there were going to be these paranormal investigators who were going to come live. And in my head, I was in that cabin in North Carolina, and I said, that's at least 60 pages. And I just thought, you can't have it. And it was just really lovely to be like, you can't have it. Like, even if it makes the book better, I can't have it. And I just kept moving. And it was nice to just constantly be telling myself, like, this is what you get. You know, and until I got there.
But I feel like then you're using your short story self to write a novel.
Maybe,
yeah. Is that what it is?
It might be. I mean, it might be, again, just trying to ride that momentum till... I talk about this a lot, but for me, novels are long trips. Like, I buy a car at a very reasonable interest rate, and I get in it, and I have a sense that I'm going somewhere, but I don't know how or when I'll arrive, you know? But I can see a trajectory. I just don't know exactly how I'll get from point A to point B. And for me, short stories, and why I've always loved them, is I'd steal a car and I'd drive it right into a tree and I don't die. Do you know what I mean? And I get out of that car and it's on fire and I'm invincible and I walk away from it. And those are two very different sensations. And with this novel, it was the first time where it felt like I was driving into a tree. Yeah.
That's so interesting. I don't write short stories anymore, but that's certainly how I grew up and how I was trained. And I always thought of it as, writing a short story was like falling in love. It was like falling off a building. It was all booze and cigarettes, and you could stay up night after night and just go crazy, absolutely lose your mind. And then you would be finished with a draft at least. But that a novel... I have to take such good care of myself, and I can't look forward, I can't look back, I have to just one stroke. How can I stay alive long enough to finish this whole thing? So a novel is like a marriage, and a short story is like, falling in love, just meeting somebody and chucking everything. But I like the fiery car hitting a tree metaphor.
And that's when I wrote my first novel. I mean, what was so hard was to keep telling myself not to crash into the tree yet. You know what I mean? That impulse was still there, and I had to just keep saying, Kevin, like, you got so many miles to go before you can do that. And it was just instinctually something I had to fight against.
So how do you feel when you're done?
I don't know. I'm trying to... I don't know if I can answer that. I don't know what that feeling is other than just... I think writing is the thing that makes me happy, you know? And even finishing it, there's this kind of echoing that I know I'm going to keep doing it, that this is not the last thing. And so it's just part of a larger life that I've made. And maybe early on it didn't feel like that, but it does now.
It's always so funny when I'm giving a talk and somebody comes to the signing table and they say, I just love your work. Keep writing. I really hope you'll write another book. And I always say, well, what else am I going to do? I don't have another job. I don't know how to do anything else. And I think Carl's patients don't come into the office and at the end of their exam say, I really hope you choose to see another patient. I hope you'll be a doctor again tomorrow. Because it's like people think that this is going to vanish or this is a hobby.
Yeah.
But it's such a job.
I think I tell my students sometimes, like, I do this partly, I write because I love writing. And if I didn't love writing, I would just read, because that's the other thing I love. But I tell my students a lot, I'm like, writing is the one thing that I really love. And then they're like, what about your kids? And I was like, those aren't things. Like, that's always the first question. Funny. I was like, what about your wife? What about your kids? And I was like, no, those are people. But the only thing that I really love is writing. It's when I'm happiest, is when I'm making something on the page. And so that's completely separate from whatever comes after the book is finished.
I also feel like it's such a privilege. That I get to do, I know what I want to do with my life, that I get to do it, that I love to do it, and that if I couldn't do it anymore, I wouldn't die.
Yeah.
It would be a completely different life. It wouldn't have the depth and the meaning. I think actually you have this too. But I have such a huge domestic life, and I feel like there's writing, and there's laundry, and there's food shopping, and housekeeping, and taking care of the company, and taking care of my husband, and taking care of my family. And those are the two things I've got. I'm either making art or I'm making dinner.
Yeah.
And that if I didn't have the art anymore, it would only be dinner. And the dinner is important. Like, I don't want to be one of those writers who hides in writing and never comes out. I want to have life experiences. I want to do things for people. I want to be a good citizen. Because I think that then feeds back into the work. I have some experience to go off of.
Yeah. No, I 100% agree with that. And I mean, the domestic sphere for me is the world that I mostly exist in, right?
Yeah.
And so for me, sometimes what I'm trying to figure out is how to blend those two spaces together, the writing and the domestic life.
God, let me know.
And so what I'm mostly doing is blending it in my head, right, in my imagination of how what I write about. But it's almost impossible. They're always so separate in the real world.
Well, and for you, it really is. I mean, you talk about the fact that since you had kids, your time has shrunk. I mean, even if you just leave your students and your teaching out of it, your time has shrunk so much.
Mm-hmm.
So you do get an Airbnb and run off and madly, madly write. Like, it's almost impossible for you to go to an artist colony where you'd have to apply 6 months in advance and figure out your time and go away for a month.
Yeah, and most residencies are 2 weeks at the minimum. And so my wife and I, she writes too, and both of us are like, we can't do that to each other. Like, we let each other go away, but 14 is too long, right? 10 is about the max.
Right.
So when I go away, part of the rush is I want to write as much as possible because that's fun, but part of it also is that I want to earn the time away from the other thing that I love, which is being with my kids. And by day 10, I'm like, if you haven't gotten it by now, Kevin, like, there's better stuff you could be doing, and I just leave, you know? So, yeah, I don't know. I'll always have to figure out how to navigate it, but it doesn't matter to me because it's what I love to do, you know? I'll figure it out.
So here's an absolutely unknowable question. Do you think that if you weren't married and didn't have kids, you would have produced more work or less work?
Yeah, I think I would. I think about this. It's nothing bad about my kids or my wife or anything, but I would have written more books, without a doubt. But I also think those books wouldn't have been maybe as good. Do you know what I mean? Living with them for so long made the book better. And if I wrote more quickly, I think those books, my kids kind of helped me figure out what's the thing I want to write about and not just always writing.
Yeah. And let's talk about that for a second before we wind up, because you know, you're completely at this point in your career where you can see the thing that you keep coming back to, whether you mean to or not, which is the relationship of parents and children and how parents fail their children. Like, do you ever think, damn it, I'm not going to write about this the next time, and then you find yourself doing it?
I think what happens, and I learned this from you a lot, I mean, you were one of the first writers that opened this world up for me, is that what I write about is family, right, whatever that means. And when I read your work, I was like, oh, family means you can expand that definition of family, right? And family is this thing that becomes amorphous. It takes in people and other people leave it, and it's constantly shifting and growing. And when I saw that in your work, that you could like pull people into that family and other people would have to maybe leave, that opened me up to the idea of what I could write about, right? And so with this book, you know, it's such a small shift, but it's this woman is not related to these kids. Do you know what I mean? I wanted to open up this idea of family is those things you make to survive. And I saw that in your work was that sometimes you hold on to other people in order to make it through the world. And when I figured that out, I was like, that's what I want to write about.
It's so interesting when I think about our families, because, you know, you still got the parents you came into this world with, and you guys had a super close but closed off existence.
Yeah.
It was the four of you. And in my family, you know, it was just like we just split and changed and grew and shrunk. And And I did have that sense of, like, go out and find your people, yeah. Go out and have your family.
Yeah. I think sometimes people ask me, like, you know, you write about bad parents, like awful parents a lot. Like, what was your childhood like? And I was like, my parents loved me. They kept me from disappearing from the world. And maybe I write about this stuff because it's really the only conflict I can imagine is what would it be like to be a kid that wasn't protected, right? So that's just what I write about because I can't quite imagine it.
Right. Okay, I'm going to ask you the question that I came in here wanting to start off asking you, because this is the thing that obsesses me. If you could go back in time to when we first met and you were a dog sitter for Rose and you didn't have this big career in front of you and make a choice about being Elena Ferrante or not, by which I mean you could write brilliant books and nobody would know it was you, and you would never go to a library association meeting and you would never go on book tour, give a reading, but nobody would ever ask you a question or say good job. You would just make the art and get no affirmation personally. What would you pick?
This is interesting to me, but I think it builds to a larger thing that I think about, which is that so much of my life, and for better or for worse, is just, it's so easy for me to disappear. And what I mean is I'm always worried about staying connected to the world, like dying, like just not being here. That would be so easy for me. It's very seductive to just dig a hole and live in it and disappear from this world. And what I've found out is that writing for me is this tether to the larger world. It's this thing that keeps me connected and keeps me from disappearing. And even if I could write those books, but nobody would know, I mean, part of what I feel like sometimes I need is that thread of another person, that moment where we kind of see each other for a second and we understand there's a moment of clarity. I kind of need that. It's just a safety thing for me to not disappear. And I think if nobody knew that I did it, then it would be a lot easier for me to stop and fall away from this place.
That's such a good answer. I think we should just end because that's perfect and beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne.
Thanks to the Public Library Association for making this podcast possible. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation to help safeguard the future of Sydney Writers' Festival. Your support will help ensure that next year we're back at the festival, side by side, listening to exceptional storytellers, inspiring readers, and celebrating writers.